Good evening and welcome to Outsources, a weekly KGNU program that provides you with content related to queer communities in Colorado. I'm your host, Elise Manitol, and this week I had the pleasure of speaking with Professor Carrie Kandrian about some of the unique issues LGBTQ older adults face when navigating healthcare. Great. Thank you so much for meeting with me. Before we launch in, do you mind introducing yourself to listeners? You could share your name, pronouns, and some of the roles and hats you have in the community.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me, Elise. My name is Carrie Kandrian. I use she, her pronouns. And my title, my role is I'm an associate professor at the University of Colorado School of Medicine on the Andrews Medical Campus, and I'm housed in the Division of General Internal Medicine.
Nice. Well, so I was doing a little bit of research before we met, and it seems like a lot of your work is related to palliative and end-of-life care, communications theory, and then LGBT-affirming practices. So before we sort of dive into the details, could you give a little bit of a definition for listeners? I think palliative and end-of-life and hospice care is sometimes this big term that might need a little defining.
Great question. It does need defining. So palliative care is really specialized medical care delivered by a group of interprofessionals, and it's designed to be accessed when at the point of diagnosis. So any serious illness is ideal to have palliative care come in. And the role really is that they work alongside oncologists or any other professionals to really provide high quality care. I think the simplest definition is for palliative care is really to help people live as well as possible for as long as possible. And one thing that's particularly unique about palliative care is because it's really focused, very team, interprofessional team oriented. It not only focuses on the physical pain, but the psychosocial pain, the emotional pain, the social support. So it's very, very holistic in that sense. Which is really critical when you're facing something like a serious illness. It is not just addressing physical pain, but all these other things that come up when you're dealing with something like advanced illness. Hospice, which is usually, unfortunately, they get conflated a lot, hospice and palliative care, in large part because I think there's still a lack of understanding around palliative care. So it sort of defaults to end of life. Hospice is really designed, so for someone to be eligible for hospice, a physician needs to believe that this person has 6 months or less. So it's really different in that sense. It's not really designed for when you get a serious illness. It's really advanced end-of-life care. And the focus is on really comfort care. So helping people be as comfortable as possible and having them live out the rest of their life as they wish.
I think it's helpful to have that definition because you're right. I think there's misconceptions about what these areas of medicine are. And I'm curious, so it seems like your work is sort of at this intersection of these specialized fields, mm-hmm. communication, and LGBT folks.
Yes.
So say a little bit about your research and how these things converge.
I can start with a little bit about how I sort of found myself at the intersection. My graduate work, my background is in communication. And by that, it's not sort of mass media journalism. It's really raw interaction, like the effects that the way we talk and listen to each other has on people. It's really focused on the interaction. And what I was finding too is that interaction is really a site of where a lot of inequalities are played out. And I, during graduate work, I volunteered at hospice, no longer is here, but it was in Denver. And then I shadowed an emergency department and just sort of really became fascinated with the way people were talking about death and dying. And when I joined the faculty at the School of Medicine, we had a community academic partnership with a local hospice. And the CEO at the time came to one of our meetings we always had at the end of the agenda item, What Bugs You? And one of the things she talks about was just the variability around why people enroll in hospice, why they don't, why some have a better understanding and others do not. And I was fascinated with the question, so I said like I would absolutely love to do that. So I started shadowing an admission nurse at the time, and so that meant and so the admission conversation of hospice is the first conversation patients and those they love have with a hospice. It's usually a nurse, sometimes a social worker. And they're critical conversations. They're just like extremely complex because someone has just told them that they have 6 months or less to live. They're often very scared. They're often very tired. They don't have a very good, usually have a very good understanding of what hospice is, what it means. So they're just like loaded conversations. And they have usually 90 minutes, the nurses, to come in and explain all that, what hospice is, meet them where they are, explain the hospice benefit, talk about goals of care. So as I was shadowing, they were like, we visited several patients, and then there was one particular patient, and her, I will call her Joan, and she had another woman in the room, Barb, both pseudonyms. And we went in with a hospice nurse, and the nurse sort of did sort of, I mean, they're scripted just because they need to be pretty effective. And it was just sort of, you know, are you married? Do you have kids? Who's your emergency contact? And she had said, Joan had said no, you know, at the time. And then, but she kept talking about Barb. And so I was thinking like, and I was out at the time and very sensitive to what these other code words mean when people are fearful about coming out. And anyway, the nurse ended up leaving, you know, knowing very little about the patient, knowing that she basically just had an emergency contact who was Barb. And the patient was pretty, her illness was pretty advanced, so she didn't have a lot of time left. And when the nurse left, I was interviewing, so I would interview the nurse and interview the patient and their caregiver after, and found out that they had been together 28 years. And it really, like, it sort of hit me in the face, like, this dealing with serious illness, dealing with end of life is hard for everyone, but it's even harder for LGBTQ people, anyone who's sort of historically been trained to be silent about this critical information. And so I really became committed to actually trying to do something about it, and really felt like with a degree in communication, I could make a change. Because thinking about the nurse, if they had just changed, you know, one question or a couple questions, like, who will need support, you know, if something happens to you, or who needs to be in the room while we're talking about this? Who is the most important person in your life? Like, just some basic changes really could have made a difference.
That's a really powerful story and example. And the way that you're describing it, it doesn't sound like the nurse necessarily held really like intense bias or anything, but that the wording and the communication and the way questions are framed can either pull information out, make people feel seen, or sort of block communication.
Exactly. And that this area, I think probably all areas, but particularly I think like one of the biggest challenges I've had working with hospices, even assisted living, but mostly hospices, is that this sort of narrative around, we already treat everyone, you know, the same. We already treat everyone with love and respect. And the problem with that is that we aren't all the same. And so if we go in and ask the same questions to the same people, it's going to work very well for some, and it's going to shut people out pretty quickly for a whole host of individuals.
Yeah. And I'm thinking about like sensitivity trainings or cultural competency, and how that has been sort of the language of often like medical models of how do we like serve different populations. My sense is that you think that maybe falls short. How are you envisioning like a different model of doing things?
I mean, they're a terrific start. So I think, do they fall short? Sure. And of course, probably some of them. But they're terrific. And it's actually, they're gaining a lot of momentum, which is really exciting to see. I think another challenge that I have faced, and I know others, is sort of this, why do we need to do this? It kind of goes back to, you know, we already are doing really well. And that has been, I think, the biggest challenge, to actually help people, or show people that this really does have concrete effects, not just on their everyday life, but actually their healthcare. So I think those trainings are great. And I think that maybe even more emphasis on just sort of the why this is so necessary and why it's so critical right now, particularly for the older generation, which has been my focus, is a lot of reasons. But, you know, I think the main one is that we don't have good data on the LGBTQ community, in large part because we don't collect these data. And so I think people, assume like there's just not that many people, so we don't need to do this work, or we don't need to invest in this if only two of our residents are openly gay. Or so I think that has been another barrier, is just sort of them not realizing, I think, and also sort of maybe having assumptions about what someone who's LGBTQ looks like. And so they have a hard time really imagining that, no, in fact, they're actually, you're caring for a lot of LGBTQ patients. You probably just don't realize it.
That's such a good point. And I'm curious, what are some of the ways that this plays out? Do you notice like folks stating that they had to go back into the closet? I think I saw that in one of your op-eds. Or I'm even thinking about sort of the basic assumptions around hospice and palliative care, how sometimes the assumptions are around like what types of support systems you might have, mm-hmm. and how that impacts LGBT older adults or folks facing terminal illness.
Yes, that's been a huge barrier, particularly around what you just said, palliative care and like advanced care planning, which are all terrific tools to have high quality conversations, but they're deeply rooted in heteronormative assumptions about what you said, about what family looks like, or just assumptions about people sort of have these robust support networks, and many people don't. I mean, gay or straight, but I think it really affects. It has greater effects on the LGBTQ community. And so that is a big, and like we've talked, I mean, it doesn't take much to really be shut out. And part of those is really, if you can't talk about the who, or if you can't talk about something, just who you are, you can't get very far. And I think going back to your first point, so 3 out of 4 older LGBTQ adults go back into the closet when they enter long-term care or assisted living communities. And a lot of the people I work with haven't come out in really until their 70s, 80s, which is devastating, really, when you think about it. And then even and by older, I mean over 65 and older, but even 55 and older, 48% have not come out to their own doctors, which is almost half. And so you're thinking like, how are they actually getting high quality whole person care if all of them is not even part of the interaction?
And especially with such a sensitive, hard topic where the training is, in my understanding, supposed to be around like your spiritual needs, all of these different things that maybe other medical models don't take into consideration, and that this specialized group is still missing a huge piece sometimes.
Definitely a huge piece. And I think that's why I've been so focused and so fascinated with this part of life, is I really don't think there's anything more detrimental. And it just seems like something it's something we can do that wouldn't really require much change, but clearly it requires more than I really want to think about, because it's been so difficult. But to reach this point, to sort of go through again for the older generation who was, you know, grew up when it was dangerous, illegal, like have faced tremendous discrimination for pretty much their entire lives, to reach this stage of life, to face something like serious illness, to go into assisted living, to face end of life, and not be able to be who you are and not be able to have who you need, it just like rips me open, because it shouldn't be something that anyone needs to worry at any point in life, and especially at the end of life.
For sure. As you've been studying this and thinking through trainings and models, are there any like really providers or agencies or models that are doing it well that you can hold up, or is it still sort of in process?
No, there's a lot of good stuff happening. There are a lot of good people doing really tremendous work. And I do feel hopeful that hopefully things are going to start shifting. And I say that very optimistically. but there are, like, I mean, SAGE National is doing really great work around trainings for older adults. A lot of local out Boulder County here is really doing tremendous work, again, from a training perspective. So there's a lot of good stuff happening. I think that's really, I feel like at this point, where we can give the most hope is really sort of changing a couple people who then change a few more and a few more. I feel like that's the kind of change we really need, because I feel like that's really the change that's going to be most effective, is if we can really reach the people who who are open to change, and maybe sort of just hold back on the ones that are really resistant to change right now.
Hmm.
And I think the stuff around the data collection, the sexual orientation, gender identity, I do feel like timing wise, it's, I mean, the Joint Commission has been asking for these data since 2011. And I think in large part, people just are very fearful of, well, I think a couple of reasons, but one, fearful of, like, you know, how do I ask this? How is this even relevant? I think that's another key piece. Like, it doesn't matter if knowing this information is not going to change how I care for someone. And that's also a problem, because I think helping people realize, no, it actually should change the way you care for someone, having known this information. But I do feel like that there are some exciting things happening around Soji collection and just pronouns. So I think we're moving in the right direction. It feels incredibly slow and backwards at times, but there are some things happening that definitely give me, and I think others, a lot of hope.
Good. It's nice to have joy and hope. And I know it's hard, because it sometimes feels like one step forward, two steps back. There's also like stuff happening on the national stage. Like,
I haven't wanted to go there yet, but
we don't have to go there.
No, we can't go there. But it's definitely a looming thing. I'm just trying to, because there are some really good people and really good organizations doing really good work. I'm hoping that eventually breaks through.
Yeah. There's a renaissance on the rise of black skin and none to hide, riding in a Hindu, killing the heroes in the ingenues. Ooh, the old dynasty has to fall, yelling war cries and battle calls. No holy water or rosary finna stop what's coming over me. Yeah. Can you hear it? The cavalry risking it all. I mean, what? No turning back for me. No. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Outsources on KGNU FM 88.5 Boulder, KGNU 1390 Denver. I'm your host, Elise Matatal, and I've been speaking with Professor Carrie Kandrian about her research advocating for LGBTQ older adults in healthcare settings. I saw that you have some projects or research around creating assisted living communities that are more inclusive. Mm-hmm. Do you want to say a little bit about that as a model?
Sure. So we got a grant through the Colorado Health Foundation to train over 800 staff at across six different assisted living communities in Colorado. It was a faith-based assisted living, so it was actually incredibly challenged for the work we were trying to do. But we learned a ton. I learned how to be very patient and really sort of believe like that. And that actually, I think probably why I sounded so hopeful in my last answer, is that to think that this, as challenging as maybe painful as it was, we were able to do something. I think like that is what is really needed. So we were originally going to use SAGE. We ended up not being able to use SAGE because part of it was, the goal was to create more inclusive assisted living communities. And so we had like a two-part thing. And we realized going in, not even being able to say the words LGBTQ, not being able to use the rainbow, like it was a very unique culture that we were going into, and the stakes were really high. Like we knew like we could not fool around or have a lot of time if to not make this as most effective. So we spent a lot of time, and I say we because I worked really closely with the administrative coordinator at one of the communities. And so we would just go in just to get a feel for what we were walking into. And so we met with residents and staff, and we got all kinds of comments, not all great, but just, it really made me realize like, oh my gosh, like people really believe that they have gone their entire lives without meeting someone who was gay or lesbian or trans. And out of like, and this one community had 380 residents, there was one that was openly out. And so I think that too is just like, and we know that that's not possible. So we ended up pushing the training back and just focus on a crew. We created this video because we thought like, from the comments we got, like people just need to actually realize we're pretty normal. And these are their neighbors. These are their friends. These are the people coming in every day, their staff. And so we, out of the six communities, we were able to find three who were willing to be part of this video. And it was huge, which we tried to share to people. Like, this takes serious courage for people not only to be out in these communities, but to say yes. And so we captured their stories. We had one who, she's a terrific woman. She's an ally. And then we had the chaplain. And so we brought in sort of different stages of the organization to help people show, like, this matters. We're investing in this, and it's important. And so we created a 27-minute video, and it was called Opening Hearts and Minds. And that was really what we tried to do. So from a two-year project, we had huge plans. But I think it's still, so we showed the video to the six communities. And then after we showed the video, we would have learning circles, which is their word or their term for basically just open discussion. And then we gave them all a survey, and the survey results were actually terrific and showed like, they didn't have a lot of them didn't have a lot of understanding of the LGBTQ community. And after the video, they showed that they did. And I think more important though, that they almost all said that they were going to do something differently, whether it was, you know, just asking, do you have a partner instead of, do you have a husband or wife? Changing the language, you know, asking people more open-ended questions. And so that felt like we were able to make some change. And that felt good. And now thinking about like, if we had done like something like a SAGE training, I don't know that it would have been as effective, because we needed to really meet these communities where they were. And I think that is another challenge with a lot of these trainings, is if you just go in with people who aren't ready or who are really believing, who've never used the word LGBTQ, who don't think that they've met someone, like, it's a whole different challenge.
Wow, that's really powerful and inspiring to think about. Like, there are targeted interventions, and maybe it is different. It looks different than what you had come in thinking it might be, but that you saw progress, which I think is hopeful, especially in our sort of polarized world where we're really frustrated with people who are not sort of caught up to us, but we can still target and have some movement if we settle down a little bit.
Exactly. No, and I think that's 24 months later, and we actually just presented at the Leading AIDS National Conference, and afterwards I'm like, I cannot believe this is actually happening. Like, sitting up here with the administrative coordinator, someone from the board, and a chaplain, like, talking about how to do cultural change in faith-based assisted living communities. Mm-hmm. And that felt really, really good. And I think it does, I think we underestimate how much time this type of work changes when you're meeting people who've lived literally like 70 years, 80 years, never having to think about these things. I just don't think we can go in and expect people to open their hearts and minds immediately. It takes work. And I really do believe strongly in the stories and just sharing the experiences to help people sort of hopefully destigmatize and just realize like they're a lot like them.
Well, I'm thinking too about how important it is that you're doing this work, especially with faith-based communities, especially because they're often the ones who are doing the really hard stuff around hospice and end-of-life care. I find that sometimes that work is taken up by religious groups or faith-based groups because they feel sort of this responsibility. And so making sure that the most vulnerable people who are dying and facing terminal illness are still able to get LGBT affirming care feels so important. Yes. And it's going to be some long processes potentially.
Yes, exactly.
I guess one thing that I'm struck with, having read a couple of your op-eds in preparation for this and the way that you're talking about this now, you seem to be someone who like feels things really deeply and cares a lot. And I guess
it can also be a challenge.
Well, I'm curious how you take care of yourself. Like, how do you not burn out? How do you not get frustrated with how monumental the task is? Like, how do you refill your cup? Because it seems like you're not going anywhere.
That's a really sweet question. I think a few things that have helped me significantly, and I think just the connection with the people. I'm a very community-based oriented researcher, which means I really don't do research that's not designed by and for the community, which I just think is, because if not, it's not going to be effective. And I think it really helps us stay focused on actually what are the biggest challenges, and having people closest to those challenges define the problems. So I think actually I've met some remarkable people through this work and who have actually become really good friends. And I think that seeing them like at 60 come out or at 80 come out and feel like they can trust me with their story, feel like they can trust me just to listen. And it just seems very reciprocal, because I feel like I'm helping them and they're equally helping me. So that has been, I think, a huge motivation for doing this. As much as it can take out of me, I get filled back up pretty quickly by the people that I work with, particularly in the community. I do go for walks. I like to hike. I like to run, and I like to go outside. I think that's also just to get fresh air. The birds are quiet now, but things like that just sort of keep me grounded. And I have good friends, and I have a great girlfriend, so that helps too.
For sure. Well, I know we're closely getting towards the end of time. So is there anything else that you want to share with listeners, like projects that you're excited about, parting words? I'll give the last bit too.
The only other project that I am interested in is actually the NIH. I applied for it several times and finally got it. It's a 5-year grant to actually help train hospice nurses to collect SOGI data. But the thing that I'm most excited about is not just the collection, but actually utilizing it. So a huge focus of the project is actually, you know, not just making sure everyone checks the box, but then actually knows what to do with it and how to provide better care and knowing the information.
And SOGI data is sexual orientation, gender identity?
Yes. Yeah. Sexual orientation and gender identity. And of course they made an acronym, so they called it.
Cool. Well, that's.
Can I just thank you? I think that would be my thanks for doing the work you're doing, both in the city and also with the show. And thanks to everyone who's listening.
Yeah, likewise. I really love finding out about people that are doing really powerful work and being able to lift them up and sort of spread the word. So I appreciate you coming on the show.
I really appreciate you having me.
Listening to Outsources on KGNU FM 88.5 Boulder, KGNU 1390 Denver. I'm Elise Matitol, and you just heard my conversation with Dr. Carrie Kandrian. For more information about Carrie and some of the resources she mentioned during her interview, you can visit news.kgnu.org and click on Outsources under the Shows and Features tab. As always, let us know if you have comments or feedback about today's show by emailing outsources@kgnu.org. Join us next week, Monday, at 6:30 p.m. for another episode of Outsources, providing you homegrown queer radio every week. That's Monday, 6:30 p.m. right here on KGNU, or listen anytime after the broadcast at kgnu.org/outsources.